This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Blessings by Anna Quinlan. Read for you by Joan Allen. There will be stars over the place forever, though the house we loved and the street we loved are lost. Every time the Earth circles her orbit, on the night the autumn equinox is crossed, two stars we knew, poised on the peak of midnight, will reach their zenith. Stillness will be deep. There will be stars over the place forever. There will be stars forever while we sleep. Sarah Teasdale. In the early hours of June 24th, a car pulled into a long macadam drive on Rolling Hills Road in the town of Mount Mason. The driver cut the engine so that as the car rolled down the drive and into the oval turnaround between the back of the big white clapboard house and the garage, it made only a soft swishing sound, like the whisper of summer rain, those first few moments after the dirty gray storm clouds open. There were deer in the fields that surrounded the house, cropping the rye grass with their spotted fawns at their flanks. But the fields stretched so far from the drive on either side, and the deer kept so close to the tree line, that the does did not even raise their divot heads from the ground as the car slid past, although one or two stopped chewing, and the smallest of the babies edged toward their mothers, stepping delicately sideways on point on their small hooves. "I don't feel that good," said the young woman in the passenger seat, her hair veiling her face. The moonlight, slipping at an oblique angle through the windows and the windshield of the car, picked out what there was of her to be seen, a suggestion of the whites of her eyes between the curtains of her hair, the beads of sweat on her arched upper lip, the silver chain around her neck, the chipped maroon polish on her nails, a jigsaw puzzle of a girl, half the pieces not visible. She was turned away from the driver, turned toward the door as though she were a prisoner in the car and at any moment might pull the door handle and tumble out. The fingers of one hand played with her full bottom lip as she stared at the black shadows of the trees on the rough silver of the lawns, silhouettes cut from construction paper. At the edge of the drive, halfway down it, was a small sign, black on white. "Blessings," it said. Blessings was one of those few places that visitors always found on their return even more pleasing than the pleasant memories they had of it. The house sat, big and white, low and sprawling, in a valley of overgrown fields, its terrace gardens spilling white hydrangeas, blue bee balm, and bushy patches of catnip and lavender onto a flagstone patio that ran its length. The land surrounding it was flat and rich for a long ways, to the end of the drive, and then the stony mountains rose around as though to protect it, a great, god-sized berm spiky with pine trees. The house had a squat and stolid quality, as though it had lain down to rest in the valley and grown middle-aged. Ill-advised additions had been made, according to the fashion of the times. A den paneled in rustic pine, a long-screened porch, some dormers scattered above the horizontal roof line like eyes peering down the drive. The weeping willows at one end of the pond dipped low, but the cedars at the other were too tall and rangy for grace, and there had been sporadic talk of cutting them down, almost from the day they were planted. The gardens were of the most conventional sort, hollyhocks in the back, daylilies in the center, alyssum along the borders. Wild rhododendrons grew in the shade wherever a stream sprang from the ground, to spill down the hillside and into the big pond, a lake almost, that lay along one side of the house. None of it amounted to much on its own. But taken all together, it was something almost perfect, the sort of place that from the road, which was how these two had first seen it, promised plenty without pretense, ease without arrogance. From the road, Blessings looked like a place where people would sit on the terrace at dusk, sip a drink, and exult in the night breeze over the mountain, pull a light cardigan around their shoulders, and go to bed content. At one time or another, in fact, all of these things had been true, but not for some time. In the fashion of the young, the two in the car, peering down the drive some months before, had convinced themselves that appearance was reality. For the girl, it was the awnings that had finally convinced her. Faded green and gold stripes over each window, like proud flags of this little nation state, where it had been arranged that the sun would never fade the upholstery. That and a small boat to one side of the pond, in which it was not only possible but indubitable that children could sit safely, row handily, put out a fishing line. In the light from a thumbnail moon, the boat, upended on the grass, shone as though a smaller moon had dropped down to earth. The girl saw the sign by the side of the drive in the car's headlights as a benediction, not as a sign of ownership, the proud name of an old family at the end of its bloodline. The pond made the car's driver nervous. It was shiny bright as a mirror. Every star, every constellation, even the path of planes, reflecting back within its dark water and seemingly magnified by the pitch black of the night and the stillness of its surface. Frogs called from its banks, and as the car rolled silently into the circular driveway turnaround, a fish jumped and left circles on the surface of the water. At the same moment, the car tripped the automatic light at the corner of the house's long porch, and it lit up the drive and the water and the bats that flew crazy eights in search of mosquitoes. The light caught the car itself squarely, so that the two people in the front seat, a boy and girl, each poised between the raw, uncertain beauty of adolescence and the duller, settled contours of adulthood, were illuminated momentarily, as though by the flash from a camera. Their light hair shone, enough alike that at first glance, they could have passed for siblings. "Oh, shit," said the driver, stepping down hard on the brakes so that the car bucked. "Don't do that," cried the girl. Her hand touched a cardboard box on the back seat, then her own forehead, then dropped to her lap. "I'd kill for a cigarette," she murmured. "Right," whispered the boy harshly, "so you could have an asthma attack right here and wake everybody up." "That's not why I'm not smoking," the girl muttered. "Let's just get this over with," he said. The car glided to the corner of the big garage with its five bays. There was a narrow door on one side of the oblong building, and three flagstone steps leading to it. The boy had oiled the doors of the car that morning with a foresight and industry and stealth the girl had not expected of him. They had both surprised each other and themselves in the last 2 days, he with his hardness and his determination, she with her weakness and her grief. Anyone familiar with the love affairs between men and women could have told them that theirs would soon be over. As he slid out and opened the back door, there was almost no sound, only the sort of clicks and snaps that could have been a moth hitting a screen or a raccoon stepping on a stick in the woods that stretched behind the garage and into the black of the mountains in the night. The girl was huddled against the door on her side now, all folded in upon herself like an old woman or like a child who'd fallen asleep on a long journey. She heard the sounds of him as though they were musical notes, each distinct and clear, and her shoulders moved slightly beneath her skirt, and her hands were jammed between her knees. She felt as though they were somehow alone in the world, almost as though the house and its surroundings were a kind of island, floating in a deep sea of ordinary life, through which the two of them would have to swim back to shore by driving back up the drive. She thought this feeling was because of the boy, and the box, and the night, and the ache in her slack belly and her bruised groin, and the pain in her chest that might have been the beginning of an asthma attack. But she was only the latest in a long line of people who had felt that Blessings was somehow a place apart. In the moonlight, the high points of it, the faint luster of the slate roof of the house, the shed on the knoll where the gardener had always kept his tools, the small white boathouse at one end of the pond. All of them were set in high sepia relief, like the photograph hung carelessly now on the short wall of the library, the one of Edwin Blessing, who bought the place when it was just another old farm and lavished money on it in the years when he had money to spend. The people from Mount Mason who worked there washing up at the parties in the old days, fixing frozen pipes for the old lady in the years after the parties ended. They all said it was like going somewhere out of this world. The quiet, the clean smells, the rooms and rooms full of polished furniture and toile draperies, which they only glimpsed through half-open doorways. Above all, the pond, the gardens, the land. The real world tried to intrude from time to time upon Blessings, but usually the real world failed. Even Lydia Blessing, the last of the Blessings, had once said as a girl that when she left the city and went out to the house for the holidays, she felt as though she were in the kind of snow globe that all the girls in her class at the Bertram School were given one Christmas, the Christmas before the crash, when she had just turned 7. She felt that God was holding her in his hand, looking through the orb of the glass at the blue spruce by the barn, the path around the pond, the pillars on the front porch, the swampy bog in the far field where the turtles lay their eggs and the cattails rose. It was hard to believe that God could concern himself with anyone in the city, with all of them hidden in the hives of their apartment buildings and narrow limestone houses. But at the country place, she stood on the great lawn between the house and the road and raised her face up to the lambent blue and felt certain that the air was transparent down to the patch of ground on which she stood and that she was watched and watched closely and well. "I don't know where you come up with these things," her mother had said, working on a large piece of floral growpoint in the failing light of the living room fire. But her father had smoothed his hair and said, "I get your point, Lids, my love." That had been the year when he was drawing up plans for the apple orchard, when he could be heard at every dinner party at their house in the city referring to our old farm, his light, high drawl rising up the circular stairwell like pipe smoke. "Why do you think Papa is so nice and Mama is so mean?" she had asked her brother Sonny once, when they were in the boat in the center of the pond where you could say secrets and no one would hear. "That is a question for the ages," Sonny had said. "Confucius," they called him at school when they studied the religions of antiquity with the chaplain in the third form. The only way Lydia Blessing could remember the child she had once been was to look at photo albums, and even then she seemed strange to herself. Incredible that the seeds of her old age had been germinating within that pink inflated flesh. When she used the mirror every day to fix her silver hair in one of the 3 pinned-up styles she used, when she rubbed cold cream briskly on the fine skin that had been sheared around the eyes and lips for decades, she was occasionally incredulous. Not about the fact that she had gotten old, but about the notion that she had ever been young. There was no longer any thought of snow globes or the hand of God. The grow point had been made into a pillow. It sat on the chair in the back guest bedroom, the one she had used for house parties only if the house was very full. Every time she saw it, which was very seldom now, she remembered that her mother had complained about the price of having it made up. Those were the sorts of things she remembered nowadays. And Sonny. She remembered Sonny always, as though he would come walking up the rise from the barn, his corn silk colored straw hat in his hand. Sometimes she dreamed about him on nights like this, and he was always young and happy. A fresh breeze blew across the mountains and dipped down into the valley and the willows on the banks of the pond, where the muskrats made tunnels between the fingers of the roots. The boy took the cardboard box from the back seat and carried it to the flagstone steps that led upstairs to the second floor of the garage. He stumbled and almost fell as another trout leaped from the black water and fell back with the sound of a slap. He caught himself and never looked at what he was carrying, even when he put it down and stepped back to turn away. "Drink Coke," it said on the box in red letters.
"Not the garage,"
the girl hissed frantically, leaning across the seat and almost out the car door as he opened it.
"You're supposed to leave it at the house, not the garage."
"Somebody'll find it," the boy mumbled, his resolve gone now.
"You can't leave it at the garage,"
she said, her voice trembling, but he had already started to turn the car slowly. There was a world around them that they never even noticed as they drove back down the drive. The girl weeping, the boy wiping his hand on the leg of his shorts. The moths wheeled and dipped mindlessly around the lights that were always left on the porch. The lights that had lit the house every evening from nightfall until sunup, since the day the Blessings had first moved in. The possums were faint gray ghosts, stumbling in their ungainly way behind the garage, their pink tails trailing them like afterthoughts. A male bear, heavy with skunk cabbage, loped across the dark field, but the two people in the car did not see him as they stared ahead. And once again a trout jumped and fell, and as it did, the car turned onto Rolling Hills Road, and the headlights jumped to life and lit the surrounding woods as though they were searching for something. Before the circles from the big fish had disappeared on the surface of the water, any trace of the car and the couple was gone as well, and the house and the land around it was, as it had been before, apart, unchanged, except for the box on the steps. The girl wiped her eyes with a tissue and put gloss on her lips with the end of her little finger from a plastic pot she took from her purse. "You want to stop and get something to eat?" the boy said. "I'm not hungry," she said. "It'll be all right," he said. "The house had those automatic light things. I couldn't go too close or I would have woken somebody up." "I guess. I can't believe I did that," he said, his voice low. The girl looked back at Blessings through a stand of birches, white and slender shadows at the edge of the black lawn. "I want to go home," she finally said. "School home or home home?" "Home home," she said. Maybe it was the last purring of the car engine, or the faint shriek of the nesting bird that one of the barn cats leaped for, clawed, caught, and then lost, that caused Lydia Blessing to turn fretfully in the big cherry bed that had once belonged to her parents. She'd heard her father's voice for a moment, that voice strangely high-pitched for such a big man, so that he'd sung tenor parts in the St. Stephen's Choir. Elegant Ed, they'd called him at school. The prettiest penmanship at Princeton, he liked to say, looking down at his copper plate cursive. "Lids, my love," he called her. The sound of voices in the night was commonplace to her now, more so even than in the old days when there really had been voices, arguments from the guest bedrooms, conversations from the stragglers on the patio, whispers from someone sneaking into the dark waters of the pond long after the house was closed up. Lydia Blessing pulled the openwork blanket about her shoulders and fell back to sleep as the box on the garage doorstep shuddered, shimmied, and finally was still. The first light of dawn, the color of lemonade, was coming over the Blue Mountains when Skip Cuddy opened his eyes and turned toward the window. He couldn't remember at first where he was, just knew by the fragile fog of the summer light that it was early, that his alarm clock would sleep longer than he had. That was all right. For his whole life, as far back as his mind could wander, he'd woken up early, easy, as though morning held a nice surprise, which had never been dimly true. Still, he'd never, ever woken up entirely sure where he was. Joe and Debbie's trailer, where he'd slept on the pull-out couch in the living room, beer bottles and played-out butts on the end tables on either side of his pillow, half of them smeared red-black from Debbie's lipstick. The county jail, top bunk, with the sprayed concrete ceiling only a foot from his face, and the sounds of people hawking and snoring and farting in their sleep. Even his room in the back of his aunt and uncle's house, just off Front Street in Mount Mason, where the maple tree outside had grown so big that the room was dark day and night. Almost 4 years he'd lived in that room after his father moved south, and 4 years he'd woken befuddled and adrift. He thought that maybe he'd known where he was when he'd lived in his parents' house, before his mother died, when he was little. But he couldn't remember. He couldn't remember anything except that his bed had a quilt with a cowboy on it, riding a horse that was trying to throw the cowboy off, and that his mother hung her stockings to dry over the taps in the tub, and that his father had a strange little stand-up thing in the bedroom that he hung his shirt and pants on overnight, First the pants, then the shirt. Shoes at the bottom. It wasn't a whole lot to remember. His whole childhood seemed to have gone up in smoke with the little Cape Cod where he grew up. Skip's pants were lying on the floor at the foot of the bed. He tried to get 2 days of wearing out of a pair of pants, since he wasn't allowed to use the washer and dryer in the big house, and there wasn't one in the rooms over the garage. Blessing's garage had bays for 5 cars and a small but complete machine shop in the back, but no washer and dryer. Old Mr. Blessing had had big ideas when he bought the place in 1926 and hired Mr. Foster to run it. He'd had the carpenters build an apartment over the garage, not too big, but big enough for Foster to move his family in, so that the caretaker was always around to see that the stone walls stayed straight, the paths stayed mowed, the roofs stayed sound, always around to fix the leaks and the cracks that came with a house with 8 bedrooms and 10 baths. After that, first Foster got arthritis in his hands and gave in to his wife's nagging about being closer to town. A second Foster, the first's middle son, took over. His name was Tom, but everyone at Blessings just called him Foster, as they had his father. "Just like a plantation," Sonny Blessing had murmured once. That Foster liked to work on cars, and his wife cooked for Mrs. Blessing meals that were always described as good, plain food, which meant meatloaf, stew, and homemade pie. The couple had had 3 boys, and Edwin Blessing had died happy, thinking there would always be Fosters to keep the grass trim and the paint fresh. But those 3 grew up and got jobs in town, and later buried their parents, and carted some of their stuff away and gave the rest to the Goodwill, or just abandoned it in the garage apartment. Now Skip cooked with Mrs. Foster's pots and pans, which the sons had left behind, when he cooked, which wasn't often. Canned soup, mostly, that he ate in front of the little television he'd put in the living room at the end of the hallway, on an old steamer trunk that actually had hotel stickers on it. If he put his soup bowl dead center, at his right hand was a big blue and white sticker that said stateroom number, then an 18 that someone had written in black ink. He put on his pants and ate a donut that had gone hard around the edges from a box on the kitchen counter. He wanted to get outside, to trim the hedges and weed around the plants in the vegetable garden he'd started behind the barn, to cut some more of the winter's firewood into just the right length, long enough to stretch from one brass andiron to another in the living room fireplace, or the dining room fireplace, or the library fireplace, or the fireplaces in the bedrooms. He'd discovered that nothing made him feel better than a nice, neat stack of wood. He'd had the job at Blessings for a month, and he liked almost everything about it. He had the inchoate and overwhelming love of the land that a boy has when he lives in the country, but in a house in town, barely 2 arms' length from the houses on either side. He had the love of the land that a boy has when he rides his bike through the forest and fields, past streams and lakes, goes hunting and fishing, and then returns every night to a 40-by-80 lot on a street where you can hear the guy next door fight with his wife through your wall as clear as if he were sitting on your sofa. Geography was destiny in Mount Mason. The kids with the little money, whose parents were teachers or contractors or accountants, lived in the neat suburbs that had grown up just outside of town after World War II. The designated dirtbags, who had transitory or seasonal jobs, plowing snow or cleaning houses, lived in 1 of 2 places. In the sagging old frame houses ranged around the center of the shabby downtown, or way out on the country roads, in trailers at the end of gravel tracks, with old cars scattered around the patches of dirt and grass like lawn ornaments, and Christmas lights that never came down. Skip had moved from one to the other, from way out to downtown during the course of his Mount Mason boyhood. Then somehow he'd landed at Blessings, the most beautiful place in town. He'd never had a job he'd liked before. The drive-through window at Burger King, the night shift cleaning at the mall, mainly popcorn cemented to the floor of the multiplex with congealing soda and blots of ice cream, or tissues you didn't even want to look at, much less touch. Laundry at the county jail, Better than doing push-ups all day next to the bunks, but it was hell on the hands. Cracks in your fingers that burned all the time, so that if you picked up a fry with salt on it, your skin sang for an hour after. He went down the stairs that led from the apartment down the side of the garage and out onto the driveway. There were no cars in the garage except for the old lady's black Cadillac, 10 years old with barely 5,000 miles on it. But there was the riding mower, the tractor, the old red truck.
"Jesus Christ," Joe had said when he helped Skip move his four boxes of stuff in. "It looks like the antique farm show at the county fair, except for the mower, man. That's a nice mower."
"Don't get any ideas," Skip said.
"Fuck you, man. I go reminding you of your mistakes."
"Don't go talking around town, either," Skip had said. He thought about how his uncle always said there were two types of people, leaders and followers. Joe had always been a follower, from the time he started following Chris around in first grade. Chris had called him Snotty then because of Joe's allergies. Joe still sniffed all the time, and he still told Chris anything he thought would pique his interest. Of the four of them who had been hanging out together since they were kids, Chris was the one who qualified as a leader. Skip knew that for certain and for always.
"How much you getting paid for this job?" Joe said.
"Jesus, you stepped in shit with this one."
"It's about time," Skip had said.
He hadn't had Joe back to the place since, and he hadn't even seen Ed or Chris, especially Chris. The old lady had lousy locks on the door, for all that there was a security system. It would be like meat to a dog for Chris. It was like he couldn't help himself, even when they were little, and there wasn't a whole lot any of them wanted anyway, besides Butterfingers and Blow Pops. They'd go into the Newberries on Main Street for loose-leaf paper just before Labor Day, quarters from their parents rattling around in their jeans, and when they got to the bench at the bus stop, Chris would unload his pockets, and there it would be, his senseless booty, a bottle of cologne, a paper of hairpins, a box of playing cards, plastic earrings, breath mints, baby aspirin.
"Drive us over to the quick stop, man," he'd said to Skip a year ago, a Memorial Day weekend, Joe walking behind him.
And the next thing Skip knew, he was doing 364 days in county jail and grateful for the deal, because it meant he wouldn't go to the state prison at Wissahonic. Chris had slid on that old ski mask. That's how Skip knew when they pulled into the lot and Chris pulled that mask out of the bag. He'd stolen the mask, too, one day when they'd been in a sporting goods store buying a mitt so they could play in the McGuire's Tavern Summer League.
"Don't even think about driving away,"
Chris had said in the lot at the quick stop, with that sudden cold violence to his voice that made people step back from him. So Skip just sat outside, sweating and swearing, and thinking about what a chump he was. And the surveillance camera read his license plate as plain as the lottery number at the bottom of your TV screen on Tuesday nights. But Skip didn't give Chris up, or Joe either, even when the sheriff's office offered him a walk. He just didn't think it was right. It was only because he didn't have any priors that he'd gotten a deal that kept him in county. He'd been let out in just under 10 months for good behavior. He sharpened the clippers on the whetstone and filled the bird feeder and watched the watery early morning light get warmer, less pastel. He washed his hands at the deep soapstone sink. Both Mrs. Foster's had done the family laundry there, hung it way back on the line hidden behind the garage, while their husbands were mending the furnace or dredging the viscous end of the pond. The old lady didn't want anyone driving up and seeing laundry flapping in the breeze. Skip took his laundry to the wash and dry in town. He washed his hands again. "Ah, hell, let's get it over with," he said, the same thing, in the same tone of voice, that his uncle had said as he took off his belt when he was going to whip Skip's butt in the basement.
"I'm washing my hands of you," his uncle had said when Skip got busted for the quick stop holdup.
Skip went around to the side of the big house, to the basement door that gave out onto the drive.
"This way,"
Nadine, the housekeeper, had said to him, her mouth drawn up tight when she'd had to tell him what to do, and more important, what not to do. "Don't use the front door. Don't use the back door. Come up through the basement. Wipe your feet on the mat. Don't make any noise. Don't wake up Ms. Blessing." That's how she said it, Ms. Like one of those old movies and Nadine was the mammy. Or maybe it was just that weird way Nadine talked, as though she were wearing a retainer, like the one Skip had worn to pull his snaggled front teeth into line, the one he'd lost and his father said there was no money to replace. Nadine's name had been something else once, and her language something else too, that she still talked to herself under her breath when she was angry, which was often. But that had been when she still lived in Korea, before she came over with their little girl to marry Mr. Foster's nephew Craig, who got her the job at Blessings.
"First grind beans," Nadine had said. "Not too small, not too big. Just right. Consistency of cornmeal."
The old lady must have said that to Nadine. In a million years, Nadine never would have thought to say that herself. Consistency of cornmeal. The words themselves sounded more like con-me in Nadine's mouth. Skip didn't think he'd ever actually seen cornmeal. When Nadine said consistency, it sounded like someone whistling with a toothpick in her teeth. He thought he must be getting the hang of it. A cupful of black beans, shiny as onyx beads, sealed in brown bags with the name of some place in New York City stamped in black on them. The growl of the little motor in the grinder, the slow hiccuping of the old percolator behind him as he went back down the cellar stairs. He never knew what happened after he left. He never knew if Mrs. Blessing came downstairs herself, as soon as she heard the cellar door close, to pour a cup of coffee, or if she stayed in bed, sleeping the long, satisfied sleep Skip imagined was the birthright of people who owned as much land as the whole town was built on, and just let the land lie there, sleeping too. Maybe she waited until Nadine came in at 8:30. Maybe Nadine brought her breakfast and coffee on a tray, and Mrs. Blessing took a sip and lifted those pale blue eyes to the sky that was the same color, the way she did when she was aggravated, and said, "Too weak," or "Too strong." Maybe he was one bad pot of coffee away from sleeping back in Joe's combination living room, dining room, kitchen, and listening to Debbie yell, "Oh, Joe, 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 Joe," through the particle board wall. He loved the goddamn job, but he hated making the coffee every morning, and he couldn't figure out why. Maybe it was because he didn't understand the point of it. He could understand cleaning the pumps in the frog ponds, or spraying the paper wasps that set up noisy housekeeping in the corner of the porch and the boathouse roofs. If he could just work like that, outside from morning until night, sweaty, sunburned, fixing the screens, mulching the plants, keeping the lawn as smooth and even and green as the felt on the pool table at McGuire's, his life would be perfect. He'd like somebody to sleep with, too, but he wasn't going to make any more mistakes. And a washing machine. Maybe he'd buy himself a washer once he'd saved enough money. The big barn cat was sitting smugly outside the basement door, a mole on the ground at its feet. The cat followed him across the circular driveway that separated the big house from the garage. At the center of the circle was a maple tree 4 stories high. Maybe today Skip would trim the lower branches and prune the holly that flanked the flagstone path to the apartment door, the one he never used that came out by the side of the pond. He looked toward it and saw a cardboard box lying at the foot of the steps. That was just the kind of thing the old lady would see from the upstairs back hallway window and give him hell about. Not give him hell directly, no, she'd tell Nadine, who would tell him, which would make him feel low, like a boy, like nobody, nothing. "Ms. Blessing say," like he was too low for her to talk to directly. She talked to him directly only when she thought the task was too complicated to explain to Nadine, which probably made Nadine feel like nothing, too. The cat bounded ahead, the mole dangling limply from the side of its mouth, and sniffed the corner of the box and cried. Skip bent down to pick up the box and carried it to the tool bench in the garage. He could tell by the weight that there was something inside. There were a couple of times in his life when he'd felt his mind slow down almost to a dead halt, when it seemed like his brain had to tell the rest of his body what was happening, slow, in words of one syllable, the way Mr. Keller had talked to them in American history when he was annoyed because too many of them had failed a test. When his father sat in the driveway, his head down on the steering wheel, just home from seeing his mother at the hospital, and Skip could see him out the window, that was one time. And when his uncle had come by to tell Skip that he was to move in with him and Aunt Betty, that his father's trip to Florida had turned into a life in Florida, that was another. "It's warm down here," his father had said on the phone, as though that explained everything. After that, he'd learned to recognize the feeling, like moving underwater in the river when the current sucked you down, and you had to push with your hands and kick with your feet, working with all your strength just to stay still. The time he'd broken his leg falling off his bike, and seen the bone poking like a birch branch through the rent in the skin. The moment when he'd seen Chris pull on that ski mask on his way into the quick stop. The day after he got out of the county jail in April and went to Shelley's back door and saw her belly jutting out beneath the t-shirt and the half-sheepish, half-truculent look on her face. Counting out the months he'd spent in jail in his head, trying to make 10 months come out somehow to less than 9, turning around and walking without saying anything, Shelley calling to him, "It's not like we were that serious, Skipper," which he guessed meant that she'd been screwing around even before he went to jail. Skip felt that feeling when he opened the cardboard box and looked inside. "A baby," he said, as though if he spoke it, he'd believe it. He was an only child, the last healthy thing his mother had managed before she faltered and faded into a life of vague physical complaints that ended with the big finale of breast cancer. He'd been one of the few kids at the high school who didn't have a first or second cousin in his class, one of the few who wasn't from the kind of big Mount Mason family that meant you had to be real careful about who you felt up in the basement at a party. He knew a lot more about machinery than he did about babies, but even he could tell that the baby in the box was more or less newborn. Its maroon skin was streaked with a motley mask of dried blood and mucus, and its small fist pushed into its face as though it were trying to shield itself from the glare of even a half-lit garage. "Eh, eh, eh," it was wheezing, its tiny, ugly baked apple of a face contorted by fear or frustration or hunger or something else that Skip couldn't understand. The baby's body was wrapped tight in an old flannel shirt, the sleeves wound round and tied beneath the chin. Swaddling clothes, Skip thought to himself. He'd never been able to figure out exactly what that meant, swaddling clothes. It was hot outside, and there was a sheen of sweat on the skull, crystalline drops in the pale, colorless down that covered the baby's head. The cat licked the down with its rough tongue. "Go away," Skip said, knocking the animal off the bench. "Get, get." Skip wiped his hands on his jeans and slid them under the baby, lifting it out of the box. There was a wet spot on the cardboard where the baby's butt had been, and another about even with its mouth. Its head wobbled as he lifted it onto his shoulder, the way he'd seen people do easily and effortlessly so many times. It was a lot harder than it looked. He wasn't sure exactly where to put his hands. The small head bounced forward, then back. The wheezing went on, then a bark of a cough. "Oh, man," he said as he started up the inside stairs to the apartment above the garage, the light weight somehow heavy against his shoulder. "What the hell am I supposed to do with this?" He didn't know why, but halfway up, he turned around and went back for the box. Lydia Blessing ate breakfast each morning in the summer months at a small drop-leaf table in one corner of the long porch overlooking the pond. In the winter, the table went into a corner of the library, since the long porch was too cold after the first frost came to Mount Mason. Both locations had the advantage of allowing her to look out over a substantial swath of her substantial property. Her father had begun the tradition, and more often than not, sometime during the meal he would say happily, "Lord of all he surveys." Her mother ate upstairs on a tray in bed. Lydia had continued because she liked to think of herself as a person who honored tradition. and because from this vantage point, she could usually keep a close eye on anyone working on the property. She could see her new caretaker on the rider mower in the back field. He was hunched forward over the seat and the steering wheel, looking, as her father would have said, as though he had the weight of the world on his shoulders. She wondered why his posture was suddenly so poor. She was of the school that believed that the spine was a reflection of character, and that only the weak stooped. She had not noticed this young man's poor posture when she had hired him, nor for the first month he had worked for her, but for the last few days he had gone about his tasks with the rounded shoulders of an old man. She narrowed her eyes thoughtfully. A bad sign for a young person to be so bowled over by the summer heat when it is only the first day of July. "Now today the coffee is too strong," Mrs. Blessing said, looking at the front page of the newspaper. "Yesterday it wasn't strong enough." "Not my fault," said Nadine, clearing the breakfast dishes from the small table onto a silver tray with the monogram of Mrs. Blessing's mother at its center. Lydia had had half a grapefruit, a bowl of all bran with strawberries on top, and 2 cups of coffee, black. Bananas, she always said, had a tendency to bind her. Nadine hated it when she talked like that. "Keep herself to herself, the old wrinkled lady," she said to her husband, Craig. "That's a nice way to talk," Craig had said. "You never mind," said Nadine. Mrs. Blessing wiped her mouth with a napkin that had her monogram on it in white. Thread so very much the color of the linen upon which it had been placed that it was easier to feel the letters, as though they were in Braille, than it was to read them. This, too, drove Nadine nuts. The fabric and the floss had faded in tandem, so that both now were a pale écru, the color of age. Mrs. Blessing herself was the same shade. So was the face of the watch her parents had given her for her graduation from Bertram's. The white dial had become ivory, then the palest café au lait, the black letters brownish, then coffee-colored. The gold band had acquired a matte finish. It had had to be mended only 6 months after she had gotten it, when she had caught it on the edge of a rented gilt chair at her Deb party. Then again in 1946, when it had exploded from her wrist on the tennis court as she served, and sometime in the early 1960s, when one of Jess's sons had carelessly trod on it on the dock while she was swimming the length of the pond. Each time it had been returned to the jeweler on Madison Avenue from whom her father had bought it. She wound it every night before bed. For her 70th birthday, her daughter, Meredith, had given her a gold watch with a brown leather strap. "I don't see how you can even read the dial of your old one," Meredith had said. "This one never needs winding," she added. The watch had been in its box, in a drawer, for a dozen years, next to several boxes of stockings from the old B. Altman store, closed now. "I don't know why I even bother to buy her things," Meredith had said to her husband the next time she visited. At the Bertram School, they had learned that old was always better than new, that the past was always nicer than the present, that white was always more elegant than any other shade except for black, which was inappropriate for girls under age 21. She'd graduated from Bertram's when she was 17 in 1937, but there were long afternoons now when she dozed off in the wing chair next to the fireplace in the living room, when Bertram's seemed more real than the news in the paper she'd read that morning. The long linoleum hallways, the smell of starch in their uniform blouses, Miss Bertram's lace-up shoes, black against the red Turkish carpet in the head's office when a girl was called in for insolence or bad temper or lack of charity or insufficient effort. The sins of the past seemed so venial in light of what she now read each morning in the Times that Nadine fetched from the newsstand in Mount Mason. Stories about girls who had sex for money and got sick and died because of it, who killed their friends and their parents and themselves. There had not been truly bad girls at Bertram's, or at least not bad in ways that mattered or were openly discussed. There was in each class one girl who was clever and slightly profane, and who had what Miss Bertram referred to as errant ways. It was always understood among them that these girls would come to a bad end. But Lydia Blessing had noticed that it somehow always happened that those girls did very well for themselves. The girl with the errant ways in Lydia's class, Priscilla North, had become an ambassador to one of the smaller European countries after her husband died, and was often asked back to the school to talk about the new American woman. Lydia Blessing had become outspoken only as she'd grown older, coming late to the realization that saying what she truly thought provided a certain satisfaction, and had no material effect on how people treated her. As a girl, she'd been hugely obedient, especially when compared to her brother, Sonny. If she slammed the door of the house on East 77th Street, she was sentenced to quiet reading in the library for half an hour. If she pushed one of the visiting children down on the lawn tennis court beside the boathouse, she was forbidden bathing in the pond for the rest of the day. She wore white all summer long at the country house. Dresses, never pants or shorts. Sonny wore shorts, and when he was older, white twill pants that yellowed as they were laundered, just as the face of her watch had. Sonny was disobedient not so much in deed as in word. He once told one of their mother's friends that he had never seen a dress that so closely matched the upholstery. He had already left the room before the two women realized what a clever insult it had been. So clever that neither said a word to the other, although Sonny was whipped by his father, and the woman never again came to the Blessing home. It had been especially insulting, given Mrs. Blessing's taste in upholstery, which ran to dark brocades from the fabric business left to her by her father. Sumner was his real name, but Lydia called him Sonny when she was a baby, and then everyone else did too. The gardeners had called him Master Blessing, and her Miss Lydia. There had been three gardeners when she was a child, one for the trees and shrubs, one for the perennial borders, and the last, the youngest, for the vegetables. Foster had overseen them all. The first Foster, not the second one. She sipped her coffee and looked from the window across the fields at the figure sitting hunched astride the riding mower. This new man must be made to sit up correctly. Mrs. Blessing thought of her own back as still straight. The faint hump was behind her, so she did not notice it. She insisted her white blouses did not fit as they once had because tailoring, like everything else, had gone down in quality. "I think he's settling in, this new man," she said. "Except for the coffee."
"Been in jail," said Nadine.
"So was Thomas Moore," Mrs. Blessing replied. She had set her lawyer to work to find out if this was true and how serious the offense had been.
"Kill everyone with knives."
"Oh, for goodness sake, Nadine. You can tell by looking at him that he's not about to kill anyone. Except for that groundhog out by the asparagus patch. I need to speak to him about that."
Of course, if Mrs. Blessing had known in the Walmart lot that the young man was recently released from prison, as Nadine so vehemently insisted, she would have rolled up her window and gone on her way alone. But she was not about to back down now. Lydia Blessing did what she wanted. That was something upon which she had prided herself. Once she moved to Blessings for good, she told it to herself and to others over and over again, so that after a time it was said to be true. Lydia Blessing does what she wants. One of Foster's nephews had set himself up in the apartment over the garage, as though it were his sinecure, the third generation of his family, to do so, and 2 weeks later she had noticed from inside the sleeping porch that the garbage cans had been left at the roadside for a full day after the truck had come. She had even used the binoculars next to her bed to make certain that she was not being precipitous. Then she'd fired the man and hired another, the man who plowed the driveway in winter. His coffee had been vile, and in his second month on the job, he had left the door to the basement ajar and a soiled work glove on the kitchen counter. She had looked at it for a long time, remembering when the ground staff never went farther into the kitchen than the pantry, the kitchen staff never farther into the house than the dining room. There had been a succession of unsatisfactory men. It had never occurred to her that she was demanding. There was something furtive about this new one in the last few days, but he worked hard, never cut corners, never complained. From time to time she would see him disappear into the garage, but she also saw him hosing off the boat just after dawn as she watched the pond and the fields and the faraway road with her binoculars. He seemed to work odd hours now, but there were no weeds around her tree peonies, and the bachelor buttons had been properly pinched, so that they were spreading a constellation of blue beneath the window of the small office where she attended to her correspondence on stationery, stacked in boxes 10 deep inside the storage closet. Stationery that would surely survive her. It was just luck that she had found him at the Walmart. That morning, she had told Nadine that the household expenses were exorbitant, that Nadine paid too much for paper towels and dishwashing detergent and light bulbs, that she was profligate with money that was not hers. Mrs. Blessing had put on her old driving jacket, the plaid one from the place Father liked so much in London, the one near Regent Street with all the guns and walking sticks, and walked slowly, her back straight, her head high, to the garage. The odor of mothballs and bath powder hung like a miasma in the still summer air of the car. The Cadillac had been dusty. It had been 3 weeks since she had taken it out to go to the club for a drink with her lawyer, and she was between caretakers. The last one had brought a woman into the apartment one night and had been fired by the end of the week. It paid to know what the staff was up to. Her mother had always said that. Mount Mason had seemed dusty, too. Dusty and out of date. Aging the way that the cheap houses around the industrial park did. Peeling, cracked, disintegrating instead of mellowing. So many of her landmarks had gone. The old limestone bank building chopped up into a travel agency, a beauty parlor, and a used bookstore. The boxy red brick hardware store refaced with some horrid imitation stone and made over into a place that sold records. She had had to drive around the circle in the center of town twice, unsure of which way to turn for the commercial strip, and a car full of teenagers had honked at her and driven far too close to her back bumper. And then there had been the horrid noisy glare of the store and the insistence of the other shoppers on pushing past her and screaming at their dirty children. But she had found light bulbs cheaper than the ones Nadine had found at the ShopRite, and paper towels, too, in a bargain 12-pack. "Could you put that in my cart?" she had said to one of the stock boys with no hint of a question in the sentence. In a locked drawer in her dresser, Mrs. Blessing had a handmade leather case crammed with her mother's old, ugly, and rather showy jewelry. Diamonds as big as almonds set in a pie crust of sapphires or emeralds. Ropes of pearls that dropped to the waist with jeweled clasps. She owned nearly 1,200 acres of the best land in the northeastern part of the state. But she was cheap the way the rich are often cheap, about small things that do not last. Thrifty, she called it. "For pity's sake, Mother," said Meredith, who felt a faint throb each time she looked at the old watch on the ropey spotted wrist. The Cadillac had died in the parking lot of the Walmart. The engine rumbled disconsolately and then was silent, no matter how many times she turned the key. She had heard a peculiar sound from the car and suddenly realized that it was a man tapping on her window. He was thin and pale, his hair a kind of flat brown, tan, really, all this way and that way over his forehead and his ears. He had small, closely set eyes and a big, wide, mobile mouth. There was a space between his front teeth. Alma, the cook at their house in the city, had once told the maids that this was a sign of licentiousness. "That's a mark on a girl, and all the men can see it," Alma had said, and she'd pushed her hips into the air, not knowing the little girl was lurking in the dim area just outside the pantry. Mrs. Blessing had held her handbag close as she looked at the man outside her car window. "You need a jump?" the young man had said loudly. "Pardon me? You need a jump. A jump, do you? Sorry, do you want me to charge your battery from my battery? From my truck? It won't take but a minute." "What would be the charge for that?" He'd smiled then. It was a smile like Sonny's, just this side of a grimace, as though it were a social gesture, and his heart wasn't in it. "Presentation," Father had shouted at Sonny, hitting him between the shoulder blades. "Presence!" The car had started instantly after he had attached the cables from a dented pickup truck to the Cadillac. She'd had a moment's panic when he'd pulled the jaws of the connectors from the two, afraid that the engine would sputter and stop again. Then she'd remembered herself and taken $2 from her handbag and rolled down the window little more than an inch to slip them through.
"Nobody'd charge you for that," he'd said, "but you do need a tune-up. I don't know who services your car, but they're not taking good care of it."
She couldn't say why, except that she thought he was too dim to be duplicitous, but she'd had him follow her home along the roads that left Mount Mason for the mountains.
"What is your name?" she had said, seating him at the table in the kitchen, as Nadine cleaned vegetables at the sink, making a good deal of noise as though she were playing a concerto of disapproval written for colander, knives, pan lids, and faucet.
"Skip," he said, "Cuddy," as though his last name were an afterthought.
"Skip is not a name for a person. Skip's a dog's name, Skippy. I knew a boy named Quad once."
"What?"
"Quad."
"What?
You deaf?" shouted Nadine. "Mind your own business," Mrs. Blessing called over the noise from the sink.
"I'm sorry, I thought you said Quad," Skip had said, pushing his hair back and fidgeting in the chair.
"I did. Quad Preston. Leland Preston IV. Quad, because of the fourth. I refuse to call him Quad. I don't care for most nicknames. What is your real name?"
He'd flushed, looked at his hands, which were cut and marked by the work in the prison laundry and the day job he had now, putting in fences.
"Charles," he said.
"Charles, are you looking for work?" she'd asked.
Oh, Nadine groaned and slashed at a head of broccoli with a carving knife.
Mrs. Blessing liked to think of herself as a good judge of people and of horses, although the horses were long gone, sold when Meredith went away to college. The cosmos grew so well in the far field because that was the land on which the horses, and before them the cows, had grazed, when Father had liked the idea of the place as a farm and himself as a gentleman farmer.
"You've got a good eye, Lids," he said when they went to other farms to buy animals.
He'd wanted to give the house a name when he first bought it, but before long everyone called it Blessings, and soon another name seemed beside the point. She thought now she'd had a good eye for that young man. He was done with the grass in the fields and was clipping the ewes around the pond spillway. Ed and Jean Chester had noticed an improvement in the property right away when they'd been out there the other night for drinks and dinner.
"The place looks grand, Lydia," Ed had said, sipping his Manhattan.
"Wonderful," Jean had added. "I've never seen the flowers looking finer."
"I have a new man," Mrs. Blessing had replied, and the two of them had nodded solemnly.
Jean was the daughter of Mrs. Blessing's old friend, Jess, with whom she had played tennis on the grass courts out back for so many Tuesday and